Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Penny, and this is the Talk with Penny show. I am on the road again, so this is truly a mobile broadcast. So if you'd like to call in and talk with me, I've been in a car for about 24 hours, and so I have no idea of what's going on in the world. I would love to hear from you. My number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. It's area code 855-346-3351. So I'm hoping that transmission is coming through loud and clear, and I'm very excited to be getting closer and closer to New York each moment. I'm going to be sending something with the phone number out over Facebook so that people will have the number to call in. Again, area code 267-521-0167. If you'd like to call and give me an update. I know that there's going to be a flurry of activity around the Murphy Bill and the compromise between Murphy and Barber was supposed to be getting constructed over the 4th of July recess. I don't know if you even heard this little slip-up, but like I said, we're mobile in the mountains, and so I can see there are a couple of people online. I'm glad you're sticking it out with me. And if you'd like to speak, please be sure to press 1 or star 1. I'm not sure which it is. It depends on which line you're calling in on as to how it works or not. But if I lose you again, I will call right back in, so please be patient as we travel through the mountains. So anyway, the compromises that Barber and Murphy might or might not be making this weekend and how that's going to be presented, we need to be really worried about. On the Diane Rehm show a little over a month ago, Barber clearly said that he had no objection to forced treatment, that he thought it might be a slippery slope, but he thinks that forced treatment is appropriate for some people. And that's the danger zone, because if it's appropriate for anyone, it's appropriate for you. And all you need to be is that person who fits into that category at that time, deemed by that person in that way, and it's over, and you can be forced into psychiatric treatment. I want to remind everybody that on July 9th, we will be having a special show on judicial accountability and the jury trial. And I think that this idea of the backroom deals that are made, and last night Tim Nolan, who also has a show on Blog Talk Radio, was talking about on this show. He called in, and I was thrilled to have him call in, talking about these backroom deals that are being made between the judges and the lawyers, and that, you know, by the time you actually get to the hearing, that it's a sham, and that it's all been plotted out already. And so they're just going through the motions. So even if you have somebody testifying on your behalf or whatever, the decision's already been made as to how people are going to proceed and what the final outcome is going to be. And so it's a veil of democracy. It's a veil of this right. And so how do we hold the judges accountable? And how is it that a judge who has no medical training, or a prosecutor for that matter, a prosecuting attorney, who has no medical training, can make such kinds of assessments about one's psychiatric situation? You know, if these are supposed medical decisions, Why is it that a judge with no medical training gets to make these decisions? And then they just rely on the quote-unquote medical specialist, the psychiatrist, who is essentially lying through their teeth. And I think that this is part of the problem. The idea that any psychiatrist who is willing to testify against somebody that they are involved with in order to court order them to see that person and to say that they have evidence of a mental illness, that psychiatrist should be held accountable for perjury since there is no actual evidence of any quote-unquote mental illness. And so I don't understand why it's not perjury to suggest that there's a biological deficiency on some level when there's no way of proving such a biological deficiency. If you want to talk to me and tell me what's been going on out there, because like I said, I've been sitting in a car for 24 hours with little access to the outside world. Give me a call at area code 267-521-0167, and we will talk. The Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, and the Barber Bill, which I think was 4574, but don't quote me on that, the merging of these two is going to be detrimental to our society. I'm particularly concerned about the Barber Bill because what it promotes is early identification and intervention and screening. And it targets young people, young adults, and veterans. And I think that this is a big problem that we're going to be facing as time goes on. And I just want to remind people who are on the line, I know the other night there was somebody who was trying to get through and we never saw you come in. And so be sure to press 1 or star 1. To have your line flagged up as one that wants to be open if you'd like to talk. And so it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that. I also wanted to just, if you weren't listening yesterday, give a quick update about the Bloor Psychiatric Museum visit. Very excited to say that we are in great conversations about an exhibit based in part on some of the research that came out of DuBois, including an 8-10 minute long video that's going to be made specifically for the Bloor Psychiatric Museum, but also a real history exhibit of the lunatic liberation movement dating back to the 19th century and going forward with including the modern human rights movement for people who are psychiatrically labeled. And so if you have ideas of anything visual that you think should be included in such an exhibit about the history of this movement or some piece of information that you think is really important that people should know about, please get in touch with me either through the show or on the tip line at area code 718-273-8708, 24 hours a day. And then we can talk about maybe your ideas about how to, create this exhibit. The executive director, Sarah Wilson of the museum, is really amazing, and she's done such phenomenal work. Now this is the second or third year that I've been gone to this museum now, and to just see the passion that she has for this and for people to really understand what it is people go through and to bring people's stories to light is really inspiring and, nice change of pace to work with somebody who, really wants to have our story told. And so a tip that she gave me about creating an exhibit, because how do you turn, 600 pages of writing into something visual, is that if somebody was skating through the exhibit like really quickly zooming through, what would catch their eye? And so that's my question that I pose to you. If you were going to see an exhibit about the psychiatric survivor movement, what do you think would be important to include in that exhibit? I'm not sure if people are trying to get through, because there's quite a few people online, and so can you open up 503? Area code 503, I'm not sure if this is the person who was trying to get through the other night, but if so, your line is open. No. Okay, I'm going to put it back on, but I just wanted it just in case that has been you. All right. I think that we're in this crucial place of being able to tell our story to other people. And, you know, one of the things that I was so impressed with at the Florida Psychiatric Museum, when I went on Thursday and then again on Saturday, there were so many people there. And they were really absorbing what the exhibits were about. And they ranged in age from young people to senior citizens. And it was really interesting to see on both days so many people engaged with the history. And, you know, Moore, who had done this original, work of creating this part of the museum of showing the history of people who were psychiatrically labeled and how it was that we were treated, really did a phenomenal amount of work in creating replicas of these torture chambers to kind of really shine light on the way that we have been treated and all of the things that we know don't work. And despite the fact that we know that these things don't work, there are still many places that are using versions of them, you know. And so when I went back on Saturday, I went to the Black Archives, which are part of the St. Joseph's Museum, as is the Bloor Psychiatric Museum. And, you know, I was really taken aback by this beautiful exhibit that, you know, takes a person through Black liberation and the civil rights movement, and all the way back to slavery and forward. And, and on the walls and in several of the display cases were these shackles. And, in the display cases in the Bloor Psychiatric Museum, there are these shackles. And so, like, this history of an oppressed people and how that translates over to other people who are oppressed, and that we're still in chains, that they still have wrist-to-belt restraints. They still have restraints that tie us down to bed, restraints that hold us in chairs, restraints that prevent us from being able to move. In some states like New York, the straitjacket itself has been pretty much eliminated, with the exception of rare use, which, of course, is a problem. I mean, the fact that any restraints are used is a problem. But there are some states where it's still actively used. And so we need to really speak out loudly about this, start to put a face for people who have been restrained or put into seclusion or shackled to a chair or to a wall, for people to see who it is that this is being, that who it is we are, and to reframe the conversation, because people think that the othering of us as if it's somehow justifiable that these kinds of things get done to us. And I think that's one of the amazing things about the D-Voice video, because so many of the people who participated talked about their experiences of being restrained, secluded, and electroshocks, and forced drugs. And when you're watching these videos, you don't know this at first, and all you're being as a person. And I, and you know, people have made comments to me about how powerful it was to see this person who, you know, somebody assumed as, you know, human, to then be talking about how they were treated as less than human, and how powerful that was, and how it reframed the idea of restraint for, you know, some people. Several people talked about this, that in watching the videos, they have this other experience of this thing that they've been talking about for years, but didn't really ever connect to because of, you know, because it seemed like, you know, the example of, oh, well, the person's got the chair in the air, so what are you going to do? And because they always use these outlandish examples, and nobody ever is, like, really talking about the real issues of power that are being, you know, disputed. Of I'm telling you what to do, and you are going to do it. And if you don't do it, I'm going to tie you up and drug you and stick you in a room by yourself until you're willing to do what it is I say you need to do. And that kind of power, how is that therapeutic? How is there any potential for a trusting relationship with somebody if this is the kind of experience that you're having? Same with the involuntary outpatient commitment. If you are my quote-unquote psychiatrist, my doctor, the person who's supposed to be like my confidant, and you're sitting on a stage testifying against me under oath, saying that I'm too, you know, I don't have any insight into my mental illness, and I must see you, how am I supposed to ever trust you again? How am I supposed to open up to you? How am I supposed to ever think of you as somebody who is on my side when you publicly testify against me in these ways? And, you know, here's another thing. If there's a psychiatrist who's testifying against somebody that they need to be under involuntary outpatient commitment, I think that it should be a mandate that in no way can this psychiatrist financially benefit from this relationship or be able to be the treating physician, that they should have to not be able to get paid for the day that they're going to court, not be able to ever see this person again professionally, but, you know, say that in their professional opinion that this person needs to be mandated, which I think is bullshit, just for the record. But, you know, see how quickly everything changes when the psychiatrist who is saying this person needs to be court-ordered into my treatment isn't allowed to be the treating physician by law. And that there needs to be some other psychiatrist that's brought in to bring, I don't know if that's really a good idea. But the idea that, you know, here I am saying that, you know, you need to come see me and I get paid because you come see me. I have a financial incentive to make you come see me if you don't want to come see me. And I don't think that in a court of law that financial incentive should be allowed to be used in those ways. And so I'm just continuing here. And like I said, I have not been in front of a computer for days now. I have no idea what's going on in the world, what's going on Facebook, what articles have come out, what debates are being had. If you'd like to call in and talk to me, please do. Please do. It's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. And if you're online, be sure that you press either 1 or star 1 to be able to, you know, chat and let me know that you would like to talk. So let's see. The Glory Psychiatric Museum, the Black Archives, the Civil Rights Movement, the connections to the psychiatric survivor movement, how we are held in slavery, how the shackles that were there. I mean, it was just, if you go on my Facebook page, you can see I posted some pictures of these things. And when you look at the shackles that were used in the on people who were held in slavery, and you look at the old fashioned shackles and rings that were used in the 19th century, just these old iron shackles. Same thing, same level of control, same level of instinct. Is there somebody on? Okay. So I think that we need to figure out how to do that, and I'm really curious if people have ideas about things that they think should be included in the exhibit at the museum. That I don't know that it definitely will be, but I'm putting together a treatment and a proposal to the Florida Psychiatric Museum. I'm hoping that, that what we put in will be accepted by them as something that they would like to have as an exhibit. And I think that the amount of interest is definitely there. Area code 202, your line is open.
Hi, I just came on late, but I think that's a good idea to include other things in the museum. Is it possible that they would actually have like a ward or something, or the small space they have for the museum?
It would be in a large room that is actually in one of the buildings that used to be a psychiatric facility.
Mm-hmm. And how old is the hospital? How old is the hospital?
Oh, it's got to be over 100 years old. I think it's the Kirkbride model, so it's definitely one of the old hospitals, one of the old institutions.
Do you think they would want to have some of their old treatments, like when they used to have a chair that people would sit in with strains? Or like water dunking, or do you think that they might shy away from some of those things that they had back in those
days? No, they have it. They have it all. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the Du Bois Human Rights Now Facebook page and look through the photos there, you'll see a ton of photos from the Bloor Psychiatric Museum. And so what Bloor had done, he had been a commissioner there in charge of the place, and with inmates, they made replicas of all of these old torture chamber restraint devices to educate the public on how bad it had been, and the ways and so there are actual replicas of the tranquilizer chair that Benjamin Rush created, and the spinning machines, and the wheel that people were put in, like a rat wheel, and the bath of surprise, of where people were like dropped into a bucket of water, and the all kinds of different bloodletting exhibits and stuff. I mean, they really are very honest about the torture chambers of the past, and the new exhibit that they have now even includes a windows full, a cabinets full of restraint wrist belts and things like that that had been actually used in the institution. So leather belts, yeah, the straps. I'm not entirely clear if restraint is still used there or not. But they are very open about it, and they do have some of the original. There are a couple of original the Utica cribs where they have them turned inside out. They rebuilt them, so you could actually see where people like would claw at the crib. It's like an adult-sized crib with a flat top that would come down that people were locked in. In the
1900s. Like a cage.
Like a cage. And when they rebuilt it, it's the original wood and all. And when they rebuilt it, they built it backwards so that you saw the inside and you can see all of the scratch marks that, from people trying to claw their way out of them. And just horrifying. And they used mannequins in these things and create replicas of them so that people could really see, like, and there's, like, a replica of a dungeon from when we were kept in dungeons. And I think they really have a very honest piece to them. And they have, like, an exhibit on lobotomy, and they have, like, the ice pick, played, and they have the fever cabinet, and quite a bit of historical representation. And so I think that one of the things that the voice can bring to that is the actual voices of people who have experienced these kinds of things, maybe not a Utica crib, but certainly restraint, in seclusion. To be able to put a human experience to it and have our, so while they've done a lot with the mannequins to kind of make it look like this is what it looks like when somebody is in there, it still in many places is without a voice of people who experienced it, and part of that I'm learning is also because of HIPAA. And so, it seems that no matter who you are or where you are, that you're still subjected to, when you're trying to tell a story, that it's still very hard to have people's actual experience with voice because of the way, privacy laws are and things like that.
So this is a huge museum that they have.
It's several floors. Yeah, it's the Flora Psychiatric Museum takes up. There's the basement where they have they actually in this new exhibit they've opened up because before they had the morgue, and so you saw like where when people died where it was that they were, and now that they opened up the actual autopsy room, and so. That's in the basement, and then on the first floor they have some exhibits and a video and the original stairway, of the great old Kirkbride model of the physical building, and then on the second floor they have all of the different restraint devices and the exhibit room, and then they have like a room. With the dentist chair, the lobotomy, electroshock, quote-unquote hydrotherapy, colonic tables, and a ton of different restraint devices. And then on the third floor, they have artwork that has been done by people, different modalities, different furniture that has been in the institution over the years. I mean, it really is very expansive. And then this is just part of the St. Joseph's Museum. So also in these buildings are the Black Archives and the Native American exhibits and a doll exhibit and forgetting something else. But
so you saw
the record,
all of that.
Yeah, it was really quite amazing.
About this, because I noticed this in my early years when I first went over to St. Elizabeth. Hospital, which is a state hospital, it seemed as though people didn't have teeth. And you might not know this, was there a therapy where they thought that they took certain people's teeth, that was therapy for them?
I do know a lot about this. Because of Andrew Scull and Andrew Scull's book, Madhouse, which I suggest anybody who's interested in this read. But there was a doctor named Henry Cotton in the 1930s, I guess, or 20s probably even. So he believed that what was going on with people was that it was focal sepsis and it was an infection. And so he started by taking out people's teeth, like a tooth that clearly looked infected, and then he would start taking out all of their innards, so their gallbladders, their intestines, colon, if you were a woman, your uterus, your ovaries, I mean, you name it. it was removed, your tonsils. And then this was killing us. Andrew Skull writes that he murdered hundreds and maimed thousands in this process. And then he decided that if he took out all of the teeth, that would reduce the possibility for infection. And so this Dr. Henry Cotton was going around and still taking out all of these inmates' teeth, very often over objection, and then, forcing colonics on people, and then, taking out all of their insides. At the time, it was focal sepsis, a terrible infection, and if they could only get the infection out of the body, then the person wouldn't be, quote-unquote, mentally ill anymore. It's very Tory-esque, with the Gandhi, whatever it is. The idea of an infection. But yeah, Cotton was
doing
a...
What are they doing that? Because I remember seeing people in 95, maybe it was because the medications rotted their teeth out, but I remember seeing people not just said, oh my God, they had a dentist, dentist at the campus, and they still do have a dentist, but they could never do anything on my mouth, because it just seems as though at that time, like in 95, 96, 97, 98, that was when the population was great over there. It was very few people that had a full set of teeth. And that's why I wondered if there was some kind of treatment that they gave the people. And this was like in the 90s, so maybe it was just bad care.
I don't think that this continued much longer, but they covered it up for so many years. Who knows who could have been subject to it. Phyllis Greenacre was the person who was doing the study. So she worked at Johns Hopkins underneath Adolf Meyer. Meyer was the lead researcher on it. And Meyer covered it up. Adolf Meyer covered it up, despite that Greenacre was showing that Cotton was running around saying he had a 85% success rate. And so they were doing a study to confirm that. And what they found, of course, was that he didn't have an 85% success rate and that he was killing people. And Meyer covered it up, and it went on for years. To this day, they still give an award in Henry Cotton's name at Trenton State Hospital in Jersey, where he was doing all of this. He got in trouble. I was talking about this with Tim Nolan last night. He got in trouble two times. Once, he got in so much trouble that the American Psychiatric Association wound up creating their Committee on Ethics. And the thing that he did to cause this much trouble was that he allowed some research that he was doing to be published in a common magazine prior to it being published in the journal of the Annals of Medicine or whatever it was. So that's what the American Psychiatric Association started, the great violation that required an ethics committee to be developed in their organization. And then later in his life, he wound up getting in trouble again because his teeth pulling and organ cutting out business was so successful and was something that was seen as so hopeful by the rich that while he was doing this in the state, while he was doing this in the state facility, he also opened up a private practice in Jersey. And so he wound up having to leave the state because they said that he was double-dipping. Because he was getting paid
people came to him to have to do these things to them?
What's that?
I don't mean to laugh. People came to him to have them, do these morbid things.
Yeah, Andrew Skull wrote about this. I think that Andrew Skull's Madhouse should be a mandatory read for anybody in advocacy. What a phenomenal work that Skull did in bringing this all together. So he absolutely was, yeah, he was, because the rich, and even Graf talked about this a little bit, I think, but the rich saw this as hopeful because now there wasn't something morally wrong with their loved one. It was that they had this infection. And so if we can get rid of this infection, then we can let you be out in public again. You know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. And so the rich were paying for this kind of, these kinds of procedures, yeah. And so that was
so going back to, again, I'm trying to make this about something medical.
Right, mm-hmm. Because if it's medical, then I have nothing to do with it as your parent, and you just have an illness, and we just need to get this nasty focal sepsis out of your body, and then you'll be healthy again. And so it's not my parenting, and it's not your morals, right? Because this would have been the moral treatment. That was one of the big issues, is that now all of a sudden, whether or not your religiosity, whether or not your values, all of that kind of stuff are intact. And then Freud comes along and says, well, no, it's all, you know, repercussions from the relationship with the mother, and, you know, which quite frankly, you know, Tori is still saying that this is, you know, ridiculous. There's that video put out by the Treatment Advocacy Center where, you know, Tori knocks down the idea of any kind of biological, he knocks down the idea of any kind of environmental influence on this. And,
wait a minute,
know, that,
didn't he? I thought he was saying that it was cat.
The Treatment Advocacy Center, yeah, but it's Tori speaking on the video.
It's Tori speaking on the video, but he doesn't talk about his, because I had understood that he had this theory that schizophrenia was caused by some virus that cats had, and that you can't have cats around pregnant women.
Right.
But that's
right.
Not it.
Well, right, but what he was disputing was that it was, because he was talking about his own life and his own childhood and his sister. And what he was disputing is the idea that, you know, his parents had anything to do with his sister's, because I don't remember off the top of my head, but whatever happened with his parents, that the psychiatrists at the time were saying that it was an environmental issue that was causing his sister's problems and trauma, and that he disputed that it had to be biological, and that, you know, and this is part of their fundraising campaign, and I see that as a nonprofit organization, they are defrauding the people. To have a statement that this is a biological brain disease with not a shred of evidence of that being so, and discounting the environmental model where we know the environment, abuse, and trauma have long-term impact on people, right? It's defrauding the public as far as I'm concerned. So I'm really going to push on that. I'll post that up on the page, on the Talk with Kenny Facebook page when I get back to New York, that video,
uh-huh.
Because I think when people really start to see, like, well, wait a second, how is it that a nonprofit organization can be spewing such misinformation to the public at the same time that they're asking the public for money to continue their work, right? And so I just, but yeah, this Henry Cotton, you know, I've seen many similarities between Cotton and Tori in terms of this idea that it's an infection that is at the root of it. Certainly all through the 1920s and 30s, I mean, they, you know, many of the people who were winding up in asylums were in late-stage syphilis. And so that was part of where this came from, you know, and part of, like, why they would, for example, keep many of the asylums held somebody who had malaria on the ground so that they would be able to inject it into people who had syphilis to cause them to have a fever to, you know, try to penicillin, right?
But that didn't seem to diminish the roles as penicillin and other antibiotics were developed, like after World War II.
Right, So that was part of what changed it. But prior to that, they created like the fever cabinet, which was like a box that you would spin in up to your neck, that had all mirrors and lights in it, and that the goal would be to get you to try to sweat it out. And so, you know, I mean, the idea of medicalizing this further, and yet, you know, today people get no medical treatment, and so, you know, and not anything medical is very often overlooked. And, you know, all we do is, you know, drug.
I'm asking about those little things because I had good information. I went to a talk one time. They had one of the NAMI conferences, and they actually, when they had the conference, I don't know if they still do this because it's been a while since I've been to one, but they have people that come from National Institute of Mental Health, and some of the things that I think of side effects of some of the medications, I was surprised. You know, when they were talking about the gene address, they were saying that for this one particular, and I don't want to give any more validity to those illnesses, but one of the schizophrenia was on the same gene address as the glucose gene. And for me, that kind of made sense. I said, well, they're purposely engineering drugs maybe to that would make people have diabetes because they believe it's only, and I was wondering if some of that was related to maybe some old past treatments that people got, like, you know, maybe they tried to fatten people up or something. And,
well,
you know, how did they decide?
With the insulin and metrazole shock. I mean, that's one of my questions with all of the new atypicals causing diabetes and working on insulin. Like, are we still doing, have we found, you know, a more socially acceptable way to create insulin coma and insulin shock in people? And are we still working on the metabolic system? Because metabolic syndrome is one of the things that winds up killing us at a rate that is higher than other groups of people. So I think that's definitely, you know, it's a question, and it's a question that I keep on asking. You know, why is it that these antipsychotics are working on insulin? And, you know, why does nobody get perturbed that we're creating diabetes in, you know, tens of thousands of people? Why isn't this seen as, you know, at the same time that, you know, Eli Lilly's business plan to give people Zyprexa that causes diabetes and then sell the diabetes pen, you know, to control it, you know, and nobody cares about lives lost. And this is, you know.
Well, or maybe the reason why I say sometimes it's good to learn some things from history. Or just like maybe many of the chemicals are used just to restrain a person or to slow them down, you know, what is it? What did they use for treatments in the past? And are the chemical companies just trying to emulate some of the things that they did in the past that we would see as really being torture? And maybe it's purposeful, you know, just like when they said that the schizophrenia gene and the glucose gene are the same address, and that's why, you know, and they're looking at these type of things. And I remember hearing someone say, well, for the future, they were hoping that they could identify the genes for schizophrenia or bipolar because they were hoping that they might be able to do some gene engineering, that was the hope. In fact,
they've been hoping that since 1850. This is how the fraud gets put on, and of course the biomedical pharmaceutical industries love it. Yeah, let's keep throwing more money at this. Yeah, let's see if we can find this someday. Oh, don't worry if we haven't found it yet. We can just pretend like we have. tell people that, you know, it's coming, that someday we'll find the proof, and until then, you just do what we say. Everything will be fine. So no, don't worry if you know. And so, you know, where they would put people in, like, insulin coma, insulin shock, of where people would, you know, the same thing. Like, you start taking any of these drugs today, you gain 50 pounds. People are starving. They're not able to process food and sugar the way that they have been. Because the drug is interfering with the metabolic system, and it's such a problem.
It takes a long time for your body to go back.
Yeah, you know. And sometimes not. Sometimes once the diabetes is caused, it's irreversible, and somebody's got, you know, or it's very hard to reverse it.
Unless you get kidney. If some of these drugs that affect your kidneys, I mean, like, you know, once they're shot, I mean, you just got to forget that, you know. So.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering also if, like, some of those things, if you could just trace them, because oftentimes I wonder what some of the chemicals that they have now, what did they use at that time, and all those things that you described, it would be things that I would not dare suggest for anyone now. And probably in the next 20 years, some of the chemicals that people are using, people would probably cringe the same way that I'm cringing now over things like hydration and forced colonics.
Well, yes, they well, and in part, it was like the idea that they were going to try to, you know, clear out the bowels if there's, you know, like with Canada now or whatever, like that kind of thing. But also prior to the surgery, so that they would force people into a colonic prior to taking out their intestines, so that it would be cleared out, and that it wouldn't be as much of a mess, I guess.
You know what flashed through my mind was the. It's an old movie with Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah,
that's what it seems like. I mean, taking people's innards out and
gallbladders, tonsils, intestines, colon, ovaries, uteruses. It's just horrifying. Like, oh, you don't need that. So, like, many of Cotton's, the people who were subject to Henry Cotton, you know, you could identify them very easily because they had no teeth, and they very often had to have, like, a colonic bag, right, because they couldn't, because their colon, he even did this to his son, Ivan. Even to his son. Yeah, I mean, people really need to read Andrew Scull's Madhouse. And it ties into where we are now on a lot of levels. And I'm going to confuse two books here. It's Gerald Grob's Mad Among Us and Andrew Scull's Madhouse. But Adolf Meyer, who was the psychiatrist who assisted Clifford Beers in starting the National Committee on Mental Hygiene, was involved in both of these methods. And the National Committee on Mental Hygiene is still on the march. They call themselves Mental Health of America, and they are pushing forward the idea that we should all be screened and treated and identified and, like, you know, playing favorites with Barber and Murphy, and somehow they're allowed in these backroom conversations, whereas none of us have a voice inside of them, and they are going to sell us out again. This is since at least the early 1900s, like 1907, 1908, this has been going on, and it's 100 years already. To what benefit? To whose benefit?
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering if this is going to be mandatory, And I don't think, you know, it really doesn't have any, I'm going to switch the subject and switch back because I want to bring something up, and if you change back, it's fine. But I posted on Facebook, there was a woman on the motorway in Los Angeles. I don't know whether, I don't know if you're still driving or what, but there was a woman in L.A., and the police came up to her, and they, the one police officer, he cold-cocked her, knocked her to the ground, and then he plummeted. Did you see that?
No, I haven't seen Facebook. I'm still driving.
Okay, well, let me tell you this. And many people that are on here, if you go to if you go to Lauren's Facebook page or even to mine, it's on there. There was this woman in Los Angeles. This is a big story. It's in the L.A. Times today. I had to wait until I got confirmed in L.A. Times because I had got a call about this. This woman was just walking across the highway now, and the guy cold-cocked her, the police officer, he pummeled her, like, depends on who you count, 10 or 15 times. But the somebody with a cell phone took the picture. You know, the only thing that I've ever seen like that was a Rodney King beating. And this is a black woman. And so they didn't arrest her, but this is what the L.A. Times reported this morning. She's in a psych facility. Her family has a lawyer because they won't let her family see her.
What?
Yes, this is true. I have this on, this is on your Facebook page, mine. It's also in Stop the Murphy Bill. I put it there as well. And the film, in fact, it went viral from YouTube. Depending on whose video you see, the KLATV video looked like it slowed down, and the video on YouTube is a little bit faster. But this guy is on top of her, and he's beating the back of her head. She's face down. And so the L.A. Times is reporting that she's been taken to a psych facility. The reason why I posted this is because it's so important. People don't understand that if a police officer gets you, and they have a choice, they can arrest you and book you. And if otherwise, they have to let you go. But if you are not, if you go into a psychiatric facility, as some people have discussed on this, on your show, you may not be able to make a telephone call. You don't have any rights to a
to visitor. Right. You have to go get your privileges first. You have to go through whatever. So this woman was walking across a highway, and
yeah,
a cop wound up on top of her, beating her.
She wasn't walking across the highway. She was on the roadway. Like, you know, like on the shoulder or whatever, you'll have to see it. But she was walking across there. Now, someone had, there's a lot of comments about it in the L.A. Times page, and someone was saying that she was barefoot, and I was trying to slow motion the picture because I can't see that she's barefooted. It's like she had a bag or something, but her family has been very vocal, and they have an attorney trying to pull up the article there from the that I posted to turn my computer on.
And they're not letting her family speak to her.
That's right. That's correct. They're not letting her family see her. This is something that a lot of times people that haven't had this experience with the psychiatric system, they don't understand that, you know, the
right.
Rules don't apply. So, you know, and a lot of times you'd be better off if the police took you in. But from this, whoever was taking this cell phone picture as they were coming by, they must have been taking a picture of something else. They took it from the very beginning. So you saw the guy put on his leather gloves.
Wow. I just want to say, area code 970, your line is open also.
Yeah, I also wanted to say I saw that, but this, what disturbs me and what gets me most is even if this woman had a mental health issue, does that give anybody the right to assault a person who is mentally ill? You see this on the Facebook all the time, that people who have mental health issues or have known to have had mental health issues will be beaten up just because they are mentally ill. It's okay somehow for a police officer or society to beat people who are mentally ill up because they're not a human being, apparently. And this is what disturbs me most, is because even if there's an inkling that I have a mental health problem, certain things are going to be assumed. Like, A, I will be violent if confronted. That's an assumption. And B, that the only way to subdue me would be to restrain me or to be violent towards me. And that's not true. Most people who have had a mental health diagnosis are not violent. And the biggest shame about this is people are being diagnosed with simple things like, and I call it simple, but, you know, you hear about the schizophrenic that has been beaten up by a cop or the suicidal person. But, okay, how many people do we know that have a diagnosis of depression, whether they're in the public mental health system or in a private system? Who's to prevent a police officer that knows someone who has been clinically depressed, so quote unquote, from mistreating them? This woman may appear to have been a transient or a bag lady or whatever you want to call her because she may or may not have been barefoot. She was African American, if I remember correctly. And, you know, that alone could have made her a target.
Let me interrupt for a minute. I just want to read a little bit from the L.A. Times, and then you can continue. The video shot by a passing driver shows a woman walking on the shoulder of 10th Freeway near the La Brea Avenue exit when a chief officer on foot catches up with her, spins her around, and throws her to the ground. As he struggles to subdue her, the officer can be seen on the video punching the woman at least 8 times in the head while she was pinned on her back by his weight. A plainclothes woman. Let's see.
Unbelievable. 8 times.
Some people say as many as 15 times.
Pinned her to the ground at the end of the video. The extent of the woman's injuries were unclear, but chief officials still reported at Friday's news conference that she was not injured and that she was undergoing a mental health evaluation. The woman's name is not being released. The woman is being treated at a mental health facility in South Los Angeles, and doctors are not allowing the family to see her, Hoffa said. There's quite an uproar in Los Angeles about it. The family of the woman allegedly thrown to the ground and punched repeatedly is asking that the two officers involved in the incident be punished, the woman's attorney said on Saturday. She's not just some animal. There are a lot of people in the black community out in L.A. who are getting involved in this.
And I don't think so much that it's a racial issue as it is she appeared to be a transient or not. I mean, if she's walking around with bare feet,
I couldn't see that she was bare feet. That was a comment that someone made.
They've been saying that since they first reported it. But I don't care how she was walking down the street. The officer targeted her probably because he thought her as someone not of her color, but of a transient, anywhere from a panhandler to just a plain old homeless person. But the thing is whatever whatever she was, that she's in a psych hospital now after being beaten up, huh? You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable that, you know, I know when I first was diagnosed, I would have believed anything the doctor said. I was in not much pain and not much comfort. I would, if they said, you know, they, you know, take everything out of my gut and it was going to solve my problems, at the time I would have done it. So they're taking people who are vulnerable, who are clearly under some sort of distress, whether it be a biochemical distress, an infection, or just, you know, not peaceful in their mind. And they tell them, oh, it's okay because you have an illness. This is not in your control. But I'm sorry, I mean, an illness is under my control because I can do things to get better, whether the illness is classified as a mental health issue or cancer or diabetes or, you know, a broken leg. I have control over what I should do to get better. But when it was presented to me, it was, you know, your brain is so dysfunctional, the biochemistry, the only way to get better is to take your their drugs, and their drugs only made me worse.
Mm-hmm.
Doing things that I would have never done if it wasn't for those drugs. So
I
know this now, but how many people are out there, and they're, I mean, who's to say that they're not going to say in the future that you need to take out, you know, your gut, things in your gut, you know. Who's to say that they're not going to say, you know, standing on your head in the corner is going to bring the blood to your brain and that's going to get you healed? You know,
it gives me
control over my life and I can get better. That's all I...
In the custody, there's not very much. I just want to read a little bit more of this. We're not going to let this woman be on trial. We're going to turn the attention on the wannabe MMA, I don't know what that means, cop, who repeatedly punched her as she was lying on her back. This was Carrie Hopper, attorney for the woman involved in the Chip altercation. So her family has lawyered up already. This was the California Highway Patrol officer that did this. And
I was just informed that MMA could mean...
Mo said, attorney Carrie, who declined to name the woman. She has an aunt, a sister, a brother, a father, and a great-grandchild. So sounds like this was I couldn't tell from the picture. Sounds like this was an older woman.
I don't know how any officer of law could be still walking free tonight after this. And not be in jail under serious assault charges and attempted murder or something. I also was just informed that MMA could mean mixed martial arts.
Oh, yes. Mixed martial, that's what they're saying. He's a mixed martial arts person. Because actually, he went up to this person, he went up to the victim, and put his leather gloves on. And some people in the comments were indicating that this was, you know, that this shows that it was he deliberately wanted to hurt her. He just—it wasn't a case of this is what some people are saying. This was not the case of someone just trying to restrain someone. Because, you know, a lot of people were making little comments like, you know, well, she could have been hit by a car and it could have tied of traffic or something like that, but. The way that he was beating her in the head and stuff, it was not like he was trying to, you know, put handcuffs on her or something. And then another person with no uniform on came up to assist him.
The fact remains, if why would someone attack a person, even if she was jaywalking? Whatever mm-hmm. she was doing was benign until this officer tackled her and started beating her. And
I agree 100%.
And I really find it that it disturbing that a woman, I mean, she had to have, I mean, and I know when I was put in the psych hospitals, they always medically cleared me first. I want to know how she could have been so easily medically cleared that she went directly into a psych ward when she was beaten as much as 15 times in the head.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted probably to control her and make her inaccessible to just anyone who would come and visit. So whether or not she even needs a psych hospital is in question.
You know, because in the way that they had her, they just, like, he came up from behind her and he gave her a punch that dropped her to the ground. I mean, Lauren, that's what, in other words, he did a single punch, dropped her to the ground, jumped on her back, and then was beating her in the head.
How is he
walking free tonight?
Well, because it seems that this person was mentally ill, or it was her fault, or, you know, it's the good old boy, you know.
Well, they don't actually say that he's mentally ill. The thing about the history, because, you know, if he's a CHIP officer, you know, those motorized cops, you know, like when he's had a program CHIP, they have no way of knowing that, whether the person has a mental illness or not. Like the other caller was saying that, they may have, since Tory and company say that 80% of the people who are homeless are mentally ill, I mean, it looked like to me that she had a shopping bag in her hand or something, you know. So it will soon come out, but the family is not releasing her name. But on television, there have been a lot of people in the community to come out, you know, about this. It's being seen as a police brutality issue.
In fact, it was
from the West Adams district of LA, if anybody knows what that is.
Why isn't this woman in a medical hospital getting evaluated for concussions and having any kind of medical attention.
She had to be mentally ill to be walking barefoot or the way she was walking. And if they want to cover something up, you yourself said when you're in a mental ward, you got to earn your privileges. You got to hold the line. I don't know about you, but I would be extremely upset and would be saying, wait until the world hears about what you just did to me. So I don't know if anyone's actually talked to her other than a psych doctor who would immediately say that she was being paranoid or out of touch with reality, even if there is evidence as a video. There's a lot unknown about the thing, but it is what we all face today.
They're reporting that 10 of the women
is
unclear.
Yvonne, one second. Maria,
sure.
Can you just finish that of what we all face today? Because I think it's really important. We all face that
if you are doing anything that a police officer or the general public find odd, if you are dressed a certain way. I mean, I used to live in Denver, and you saw people who were homeless all the time, and you would see police officers for no reason other than they were homeless, approaching them and giving them a hard time. Now, not everybody who is homeless is mentally ill. That is a fallacy. But having been in a homeless shelter, you know, they throw you out at 9 o'clock in the morning and said, don't return until 5, what are you supposed to do? You don't have money for a bus ride. You don't have, you know, and just be existing, whether or not you have mental illness or not, but you look homeless, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The mentally ill aren't vagabonds on the street. Okay.
Well, this woman is supposed to be homeless, but this is further. I just wanted to read more. There is no justification for the way that he savagely beat her, Harper said. He's the one that should be in a mental health facility. I would think from this video that this, I would be wanting to evaluate him.
No, he should be in a mental health facility. No,
he should be in jail.
He should be in jail. Absolutely. We cannot keep on pushing this off onto other people. The news, the way they're doing this, that this is the way that somehow, because if you're crazy, this is what crazy people do. Absolutely not. This guy should be in jail. This is a crime, and he should be in jail.
What makes what he does less, he did less crazy than what she was doing?
Now, what they're doing is this. People need to listen and to what's happened is because the police have been, there's an unholy alliance now with law enforcement and behavioral health. And so they know the people now. So when they do bad things, it's very easy for them to say that to cut a person off. As I said when I first brought this up, is that if she was arrested, they would have to charge her with something. And in this case, what would they charge her with? Walking on the shoulder? That's nothing illegal about that.
Well, jaywalking is a ticket, not a jail sentence.
This is not jaywalking. You know, she could have been in a car, and it could have been disabled. She was not jaywalking. She was not going against traffic or anything like that. In other words, she's got a very good lawsuit because she was not doing anything illegal, you know. At the time, they were just the article was saying that they were trying to prevent her from possibly getting hit. But if you were trying to prevent somebody from getting hit, you don't need to cold cock them and beat them about the head like this video showed. I mean, like I said, the only thing that I've ever seen that was like this was a Rodney King beating or either where we were listening, Lauren, to that guy when he was on the ground when his family had called the police and he was on the floor. And they shot
right,
him like
Michael,
something like
right, Michael, in Fort Bend, Texas, right.
I mean, you're already to the ground. If you're
right.
An officer, you got handcuffs. I mean, you could cuff the person. I mean, you don't have to to browbeat them. But, you know, it's going to be justifiable because in most jurisdictions, failure to obey a police officer's command is resisting arrest. So I know people
and,
who don't
and that would
like,
be her word against his because we saw the beating, but what happened before the beating, we don't know. And it would be her word against his.
Her, so she's
but,
locked away, and she's isolated. Just imagine this. This happens to you. Whether you have, we don't know if she has any mental health history or not. The thing about it is you're locked away somewhere. You can't see your family, your loved ones. You know, they're telling you whatever. They could tell you, look, you could be here forever. You're not in a jail because even in a jail, I think they still let people have a phone call or something, or they have a right to say, I'd like to see my attorney. So, you know, the family has gotten an attorney. She's not being allowed to see her family members. And that's what I'm saying, that is a thing that people don't understand is under using psychiatry, when the police have psychiatry as a tool, habeas corpus does not does that apply. So they can hold you for evaluation. And as Lauren always says, what's it, 72 hours?
Mm-hmm. In New York, but in some places it's as much as 9 days, right? What they're trying to do in Colorado is to keep somebody
yeah.
there for 9 days. If you fall
so a lot of things, in those days, a lot of things can happen to you, you know. And they're not saying, they had said first that she was at Martin Luther King Community Hospital, and then they said no, the article says no, the CHIP people said no, she's not there. I have to credit Helen McDonald from Connecticut. She was the one that alerted us to this incident. But so that's the thing. You could be your family members can be looking for you. Because what do they say when you're in a psych facility and they call and they say, is that person there? What do they say?
And this goes beyond even just, anybody with a psychiatric label. The idea that a police officer, they see us all as less than human, that they're superhuman, and we must bow to whatever they do, and if we don't, then they will beat us into submission and lock us up in a mental institution and say that, you know, the reason that this happens is because that person is, you know, quote-unquote mentally ill and needs to be controlled. And then, you know, why are we allowed to be seen as less than human still in 2014? Where at what point, where there was a line in the article that she's not an animal, at what point are people going to be treated as decently as human beings? When does
Lauren, if this was an animal, there would have been more of an uproar.
Well,
that's
true.
You know, when a cop shoots a dog dead, you would think, not that a cop should ever shoot a dog dead, but they're spending time justifying the shooting. You know, the dog had to have something wrong with it or whatever. But sometimes animals, if an animal gets mistreated like that, it is more people are out there are standing up for that animal than they would a human being, because it's always assumed in the public that, A, that she must have been mentally ill if she's in a psych ward, and, of course, people who are mentally ill need to be subdued or shackled because they're out of control or their mental illness, quote-unquote, makes them violent, which is not true. But that's the way it's seen in the general public. And the problem is the stigma itself perpetuates the problem for those people who are just walking the streets doing whatever they're doing. But it just shows that anyone is vulnerable, because we don't know her history, but we do know that she's in the psych ward.
Well,
okay,
as a former U.S. Marine, this is some comments, who served as provost marshal, I think this officer should be fired. I've seen officers take down and cuff men who were really resisted arrest and did not need to be beaten like that. The man is unworthy of his badge. Maybe he has mental issues. The other officer should have received the uniform officer's punishment. I don't know why any man in uniform with a badge can beat a woman on the ground in the head of all places and keep his job. He just should have rolled her over and cuffed her. Did his lie really make it acceptable? And that was one of the comments. Here's another one. There is no excuse for the cop's action. The victim has effectively disappeared through the simple mechanism of police that she was mental. The cop should not be shielded by anonymity. Publish his name and record of abuse. Any monetary damage should be levied personally against the cop and his family. I mean, there are there's a lot of comments, and most of the comments there are for the victim and not and which is a good thing. And when these
things
come
out, I don't think anybody
out,
could really
so,
justify that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but like I said, they are taking her under, and they've taken. She's disappeared now. You know, that's what they used to do in the former Soviet Union. They take people away. And some comments on another forum not on the LA Times, was asking about steroids, which I don't see if it was a cop on steroids or something, because he was, you have to learn when you get to a computer, whenever you land or whatever else in a couple of days, you had to look at it because you can see what do they use the words? When you get excessive force. It's just excessive force. And just like the other caller was saying, this could happen to anybody because they can use this. Like right now, there's 199 comments on this story in the LA Times. And I'm glad to see people are speaking out about these kind of things, because if it was reversed, if this was some case where someone had killed somebody, they would be making all kinds of reasons why this is a good reason for assisted outpatient. This is a reason why you should not be calling police for medical emergencies, because they do not know how to treat people who are having a medical emergency. We don't know anything about this woman yet, just that from the picture she was just walking on the highway, and the chip officer came up there, and, you know, I guess you have to see it to believe it, but
the problem really isn't that this one particular woman was mistreated and had excessive force. The problem is it happens every state of the union. It's happening by people who are police officers, people who are walking the streets, attacking people who they think that deserve to be attacked. I mean, the thing is it's not this one person who was on the street who may have been mentally ill or not, but that people who are known to be mentally ill, police officers, are violent. They see them as, from anywhere. When someone's suicidal, you know, to shoot them 11 times is not going to help you out if you're the police officer.
Like in the case of Michael Blair. Right. Absolutely.
Right. But the thing is it doesn't matter. It's the fact that, especially if you're known to be mentally ill, you are more vulnerable than the general public for police violence and mistreatment, because their attitude is these people need to be restrained, these people need to be locked up, these people are not going to be believed. I can't tell you how many times I would say something that somebody did to me, and just because I had a mental health diagnosis, no one believed me because, you know, I must be exaggerating, or I must have been in an episode where I didn't know reality. I must have been psychotic or something. The fact is, people with mental health issues on the whole, especially if they're in public mental health and they're at the mercy of Medicare, Medicaid, or the public social system, they are mistreated. Their rights are often totally violated for their own good, quote unquote. I can't imagine. I remember all the times I've been admitted to a psychiatric ward, I was given a Bill of Rights, okay? Now, you may need to earn a privilege to use the phone, but you have the Bill of Rights to have written communication, to refuse meds. You have all these rights. Does this person know that she has all these rights? That's what I want to know. And was all her rights null and void because she's already a known mental health patient? You know,
there's something strange about this.
And I, I just want to say something really quick just before it switches out, because I don't want to forget. I think one of the main things here, though, like with Michael Blair, like some of these other big situations, is Esmond Green, is that there's videotape evidence. If there wasn't videotape evidence, this would have never even been brought to the public's attention. And so, you know, Maria, what you're talking about all of these people who are experiencing this every day, who aren't being videotaped and having any evidence of this happening
right.
to them, that this is just rampant as a problem in our society, the way people are treated. And you know, I don't know if the answer is everybody should be carrying a video camera on them. Probably not. But, you know, the idea that the only time that the public gets to the public is when, you know, the media has a story, you know, if it bleeds, it leaves. And now that you have some, you know, economic generating, you know, profit for themselves, and that's why they play it, you know, because people will watch. And so, you know, I think that's another whole issue, but that's all I want to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, it says watch the video and look at the Chip Dorff pin. The Chip, well, this is what they're calling him, a dog, had put on his leather strap gloves before he accosted the woman. Leather strap gloves are not part of their uniform. That indicates he wanted to strike the woman with his fist before his violent assault, and this woman is a grandmother. So everything in the video points to misconduct. And I don't know anything about these gloves. Maybe someone else that's listening does know whether these it's illegal to have these kind of gloves or whatever. But everybody, I think, is right. It's good that it's unfortunate that this happened to this woman. And I'm not certain that I think that so many people in the community are upset about this. But you know, the way that they're trained, and you know, we've seen people go to court before and nothing happened to people like this. This is probably going to have to be settled in a lawsuit. I just hope this. I really feel for the safety of this woman. She's really not.
Well, sure, she's in a mental institution. You better fear for her safety. I mean, nobody's safe there.
Well, the fact that she can't communicate with her family could mean she's being drugged. That she doesn't even know where she's at.
Right.
You know.
Yvonne, I don't know where am I at.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, the whole thing is not so much this particular woman, which is horrible, but that it's happening every day.
Day.
To people who are mentally ill or not. You know, if I'm sure that people have been attacked by cops, and ended up in the psych ward because the cop did something wrong. But what a better place to put someone where they can, I mean, I don't know about you, but the very first time I was given Ativan, it wiped out my short-term memory, and it disturbed me because that's something I take pride in, that I have a good short-term memory. And you know, because I did not consult, I was never consulted on the Ativan because I knew I wouldn't want it. So who's to say when she does service again that she'll remember any of it? You know, there's so much corruption in this that it's even beyond
the brain damage.
Never
does. Brain damage. I mean, just the idea of being hit up to 15 times in the head by somebody, and she's a grandmother. She's an older woman. Like, what possesses somebody to be able to do this? And why is this person not held criminally responsible? Why is this person still walking free?
Right. Well, because he's a police officer.
It's the police, and that's why I say you have to pay careful attention to in these laws and things how they marry Department of Justice, because even in that Murphy bill, there is some reference to also oversight by the Department of Justice. So,
Oh, yeah, and grant fundings for the police and and getting, you know, the whole, I mean, the whole involuntary outpatient commitment thing requires police time. They're the ones who are going to be sent out after us. People need to be very concerned about this. And Maria, I hear your point that this is a horrible situation that this one woman is facing, but that this is going on every day, everywhere, and that people don't ever know about it because these people just wind up getting locked up in an institution. You want to cover something up, make somebody look like they're out of their minds and they don't know what they're talking about.
The thing is they know that drugs can wipe away your memory, too. So even in court, whatever the person recollects will be under suspect. I mean, it's all one big cover-up. And the general public doesn't realize that anyone is subject to this.
And by the time she goes disheveled and looking bad, you know, hair all messed up, because this one, you know, so they're going to, you know, if she will not be a good picture by the time they get caught, and I'm quite sure they're going to make sure that they have it all filmed and everything, too.
I mean, and how often do you see people when they do go to court, whether it's, you know, those people who are put on a commitment and they go to court, how often are they in, you know, their hospital garb when they're in front of the judge? You know, there's
right.
No dignity and respect in this whole system.
They won't be in court because they're going to, it's probably that they don't have anything. They have no, they have film. They don't, unless she shoplifted something from a nearby mall and ran onto the highway, they're not going to have anything. I mean, she's going to, I mean, they couldn't have taken her to jail. That was
well,
the only place to cover it up.
But I think that the statement that Maria just made about then you go to court and you're wearing a hospital gown and you're totally dehumanized and you just look like, you know, a quote-unquote mental patient. And, you know, obviously you need somebody to care for you because look at the mess that you got in when you were all on your own. So again, we have this judicial accountability. Where is the democracy? Where is the due process? Where are people's rights being protected underneath this system where you can't even make yourself, you know, your presentation of your personal appearance and such that you don't even have a shot because they're just going to, you know, haul you out, drugged up, and, you know, and insist that this is what's necessary and this is what's needed.
And your Bill of Rights say you have the right to your own clothing. So, I mean, the thing is, because we haven't really talked, I don't think, about patients' Bill of Rights. And the thing is clearly this person's Bill of Rights isn't being adhered to because regardless of her getting privileges or not, she has the right to talk to a lawyer if she wants to talk to a lawyer. She has the right but we don't even know if she's in her... she's in a psych hospital, but was she ever really, truly medically cleared? Is she within, does she have a concussion? Does she know where she's at? Was she probably intaked? I mean, yes, I agree that psychiatry is a fraud, but we also have to be careful for our brothers and sisters out there who are in or forced into treatment. Are their rights being adhered to?
Absolutely.
Because,
yeah,
I mean, it's fine and well to say psychiatry is a fraud.
Or they're going to arrest you and take you up to the big house, you know?
Well, and the
but
thing
no,
is
Maria,
they want to...
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right because, yeah, I mean, A, you know, obviously it's a fraud and that they have no right to be doing any of this, but while they are doing it and while there's plenty of government and state power going behind it, who's protecting the rights of people who are subjected to this while they're there? And how do people, you know, how are people informed about the fact that they have, you know, basic rights as a, you know, as a patient? I think that mm-hmm. and I don't, you know, unless you
hurt pretty bad because the way he was swapping on her and putting her head into the cement, I mean, she has got to have a concussion.
And unless you happen to read the thing on the wall that's behind the door and, you know, well hidden, you know, because in many facilities they don't hand you the Bill of Rights, you know, it's just posted on a wall somewhere. You know, you may not even know that you're aware of it. You may not be aware of mental hygiene legal services or that you can get a lawyer or anything.
Or a patient representative. And the thing is when you're under a lot of distress or you're mentally not clear, whether that's a mental illness or not, you don't even care yourself. All you know is something bad is happening to you, and you want it to stop.
I'm not even buying into the fact that we don't even know if she has any mental health history. This could just happen to be covered up. We had a case many months ago where a woman came here from Connecticut. She came to the White House. She bumped into some poles and backing up. She hit a police officer, bumped into a police officer, Capitol Hill police. They pulled guns. She backed away and tried to get out. They chased and
fleeing.
The street is made in down in the area where the Capitol, White House, and everything, they have one-way streets, so you can only go certain ways. And so then she was, the call went out that she was heading toward the Capitol. Well, that's the only way that she could go because the White House is a pedestrian walkway. You can't have cars through there. A lot of people that come here don't understand that certain places you cannot drive your car. So they lit her up.
Right.
They killed her.
Right.
And then
I think that what Maria is talking about, though, is so important because it's what happens once you wind up in one of these institutions. Who is informing you that you have rights? Who is making sure that you have access to an advocate? Who is making sure that you have even food and water and that somebody is telling you that you can refuse this stuff and that you can have a hearing and that there's a lawyer that's available to you if you can't afford one and, you know, getting you in touch with your family and all of this other stuff. You know, I think that these are major issues. Because while, you know, we do, like, talk a lot about what a load of crap, you know, psychiatry is still super influential and very much in existence. And so for while people are subject to it, you know, how are the idea of their rights on a national level being transmitted to people? How, you know, what are the ways in which that happens and how... How are people being held accountable when it fails? When an institution fails to protect the rights of the people that are held inside of its walls or in involuntary outpatient commitment for that matter, or outpatient or whatever, how are they being held accountable for failing to protect the rights of people who are there? And I think it's just really urgent that we continue to remind everybody about that. And that people do have rights.
Thank you, Lauren, because we could stand and shout, you know, psychiatry's a fraud, but we have millions of brothers and sisters out there who either have bought into that lie or have no choice because they immediately went into the courts and they're forced to take treatment. And the thing is we could shout all we want, but if our brothers and sisters out there are being mistreated or ill-informed or tortured, what good is us standing outside saying psychiatry's a fraud when we're not protecting our own people? I mean, that's part of the civil rights that we have, too, because, I mean, I can't tell you how many times, you know, maybe I got halfway decent care, but I've had people who've done an intake and said, I know you probably know your rights already, but I'm going to go through them again. And I use them. I mean, I've even asked for stamps, and I've had them make long-distance phone calls for me and, you know, went to the ombudsman or the patient representative because I listened when I had those patients' rights given to me. And the thing is I think sometimes we're hitting against the pricks, so to speak, and that sometimes our cause is going to just be ignored. But if we're telling our brothers and sisters that psychiatry is a fraud, that psychiatry has no right to exist as it does, and then we're not there to stand next to them when they're being abused or neglected. I'm not saying that that's not what you're doing. This whole radio show is kind of doing that. You're informing people and letting people know that we're not going to stand for it anymore. But sometimes I think it's woefully inadequate just to sit there you guys are not casual. You're very passionate. But see the passion to make sure those people who are being mistreated have a place or support to go to, because hopefully sooner or later there'll be millions of people that'll wake up and say, hey, this mental illness story is a fraud. I mean, that's my dream, that we all wake up, anybody who has a diagnosis, and learn that, no, it's not your fault. You know, that's what we all want to hear. Your mental distress is not your fault. It's not your parents' fault. It's not. But I don't want to hear that if it's a lie, you know. I want to hear the truth. And, yes, people act poorly when they're not taught how to act correctly. And what is correct? And what is tolerance? And what is, you know, all this? And I just find that people in institutions are not truly, I mean, because the first things they're given is medications. And those medications, Maria, start right away.
Maria, I agree with you so much, and I think that this is one of the reasons why I really, you know, who's got access? I can't go into an institution. I can't talk to people who are in, you know, in a waiting room in an ER. The people that you're relying on doing that work for the, you know, quote-unquote peer industry. While there are some of them who absolutely will inform everybody they come in contact with about what their rights are, there are some phenomenal advocates out there, and I am not saying that everybody who works in the peer industry is not. But, you know, the overwhelming majority of them won't touch the issues of rights because they're afraid of losing their funding. And so the people who are designed in the position to go in and to inform our brothers and sisters about their rights and help them have them protected are too afraid of losing their nice little cushy jobs to do so. And I think that that's something that we absolutely need to change.
And some of the jobs are not so good. They're barely above minimum wage.
Well, that is true, too. Which almost makes it worse on some levels. You know, but I mean, they're not being trained to go in and protect rights. They're being trained to be junior case managers. You know what I mean? Those are the roles that people are taking. And so I think that one of the things that we need to do is strengthen the integrity of peer services and bring that further to the further to the point, and to hold these institutions accountable for what they legally have to do concerning the Bill of Rights. you don't need a somebody in a quote-unquote peer position there in order to have your rights given to you.
I don't think that's the, I mean, no parent's ever talked to me about the patient's bill of rights, but the peer, we used to call them peer specialists, now they call them peer supports. 10, 15 years ago, it was a different, at least in Colorado, they had a different role. It was about talking to a friend. Now it's about, yeah, they're like case manager aides. They're bringing you places. They're essentially spying on you, which is not.
Yeah, and 20, 25 years ago, it was about helping protect your rights. And so,
right.
Yeah, over time, it keeps getting dwindled down more and more to the point to where you can't even tell them apart from the people who are, you know, your keepers and your jailers, and they are spying on. They do have people spying on them and ratting each other out, and it is a nasty little game. But that there are these rights that we have when we're institutionalized, when we're involved with psychiatry, that are just not people are not informed about them, and they're not enforced. You know, if they were enforced, the issue of forced drugging wouldn't be an issue, because our right to refuse medication would just be upheld. And so I think the larger issue.
I just want to give you an update, because while you were talking about this, I went online, and evidently CBS has gotten news of this story, and there's an update. We do know who the woman is. She's a 51-year-old grandmother, Marlene Pinnock, and she now has been seen by her family, but they kept the family at bay for a whole week. Foyer in order to see their loved one.
Wow.
We do know who she is.
You said she, how old was she? She was a grandmother?
The 51-year-old grandmother is seen being pulled to the ground and pummeled by unidentified California Highway Patrolman.
Guy should be in jail.
According to the CBS and the LA Times, everybody is not saying anything about her mental health status or anything. They're all saying that the police officer was, that this was excessive force.
It really is just a
body face, arms and shoulders, the lawyer said.
It still doesn't negate the fact that she ended up in a mental hospital. She, whether or not she had that status before the incident is neither here or there for me. The thing is to cover up the police officer's actions, they made her indisposable in the
right.
name of mental health. You know,
right.
And the thing is this is not an isolated situation. Yeah, maybe not everybody gets hit in the head, but people are getting assaulted by police officers and they're ending up in psych wards.
Well, sometimes they end up worse than that, you know, in a state hospital, because you have some people, they go disappear. Everybody says, well, except all the hospitals. They're asking for a federal investigation.
Yeah, I think we need to collectively come together and really have some kind of massive educational campaign on keeping the police away from us and not having them be the people who are coming to, you know, quote unquote help us. And at the same time, making sure that people are aware of their rights and that you know your rights.
Lauren, do you know about the CIT program?
Is that the...
Tell me, crisis intervention, they're training police officers, at least here in Colorado, they're trying to train police officers how to deal with people with no mental illness and in a crisis. And they even go to the drop-in centers and talk to groups of people who have mental illnesses, and we tell our horror stories about being confronted by police officers and how we would like to be treated. But the thing is, you know, that takes a long time to train all the officers. And the second thing is it's something they do to look good to their bosses, but I don't see that they truly understand or truly follow what they've been supposedly trained to do.
I've been thinking about that. That's why I was, I wouldn't even be involved in CIT. There were a group of us that we wouldn't even be involved, even if they paid us. And because really what they're doing is they're using the police. They're making them brown shirters. So police don't want to handle these types of calls. If you have a mobile crisis unit or you should employ peers as if you're going to have it as ride-alongs, because they don't want this. They don't get any credit when they take someone down and take them to the hospital. So it's a lose-lose situation. It would be much better if people claim this is a biological chemical illness. Be much better to have EMT people to be called versus to have someone coming out with a gun. You know, the point is that, Maria, you said this quite well, is this could happen to anybody, because when you get into a psych facility, you disappear.
Hey, really?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Maria.
Well, in psych hospitals or drop-in centers or mental health centers, you cannot get information about everyday people cannot get information about the people in there, their patients, their clients, whatever you want to call them, because they're supposed to be protecting our rights to privacy, but it's more likely to protect the doctor or the staff, because in Colorado we hear of stories of people in the state hospital in Pueblo, being put in four-point restraints and then choking on their own, dying because they choked or was asphyxiated, I can't say that word, because they were 4 points down on the bed, with their face down on the bed, and they were not able to hold their head up high enough to breathe. The thing is because under the guise of our privacy, they cannot talk about it. And the thing is abuse is often more prevalent than help, because, of course, whether, you know, if it's a chemical thing in our brain, we don't know what we're doing, and nothing personal, but we're going to protect ourselves, because you could chemically go after us, you know, your chemical malfunction could make it that you attack us, so if you're going to attack us, we're going to have to restrain you or shoot you up with something to keep you calm or make sure you take your pills. I don't care what they want to call it. It's just plain wrong, but it's legal. As it stands now, you know, everything is secret. I mean, under the guise of our privacy rights.
Right.
Although any doctor could see it.
Yeah, I mean, even in New York, there's that public health law that prevents the police from going in to do an investigation of if there's a death or something like that, the police can't even find out what happened because the institution hides behind privacy rights. And so nobody's ever held criminally responsible for the way they teach us, treat us, and it is all legal. It's legal to drug us. It's legal to tie us to beds. It's legal to lock us in rooms. It's legal to withhold food from us. These are all legal things, and that's what needs to change, that these things that are seen as legal need to become illegal, and that the people's rights to be protected from abuse and torture and ill treatment need to be protected and promoted. And people who are in positions of, like, peer positions or whatever should not be getting in trouble if they're protecting and promoting human rights of people that are in these institutions and places. And I think that, you know, it's another tragic story. It's another person who has been, you know, abused by and damaged and you know, maybe even nearly killed by the police, who then gets locked up in a psychiatric institution with little to no protection. And who knows what drugs that she's been put on now, and 51-year-old grandmother hit 15 times in the head, police officer. So disturbing.
Well, you know, Lauren, not for anything, she was a 50-year-old woman. Whether she was a grandmother, mother, or anything else shouldn't really matter. I see that as propaganda on the other side. She's a 51-year-old human being that should not have been treated that way, whatever her other personal, you know, if she was a 90-year-old grandmother, she wasn't supposed to be treated that way. And so just because she's a grandmother,
Well, I mean, no, obviously she wasn't supposed to be treated that way, but the idea that she also wasn't a young woman who was, I mean, not that any young woman would deserve this either, but whether this would be legal, but the idea that somebody would go after an older woman and attack her in this way, and to her family and friends, obviously, you know, keep the fight up. And I, you know, we've got just another minute left or so I want to just thank you, Yvonne. Thank you for calling in and, you know, talking about the story, and Maria, for your perspective on it and this issue about how it is that we're treated and making sure that people are informed about their rights and that their rights are protected.
Thank you, Lauren, for the show.
I think we need to just keep on speaking out, and tomorrow night I will be on 9 to 11. I want to thank everybody who listened in tonight, and if you want to give a call tomorrow night, please do. If you have a tip, the line to call is area code 718-273-8708. And I'm going to ask you to keep on speaking out, and until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon.